Okay, I'm Jim Bowery. I'm talking to Craig Cobb. Craig, start talking a bit about your background. In other words, where you came from, who you are, and how you came to essentially sacrifice your social acceptability to the moral zeitgeist.
I grew up in Northwest Missouri, and my father was a land developer and an architect. He flew aircraft, he owned his own, and my mother was a teacher, elementary school, and I was the oldest of several siblings. So from a very young age, I was a little bit different. I was always interested in information. I spent hours and weeks and months, I'm sure, in the libraries until the internet. And I used to even mail away for books at a very young age, even pamphlets, 50 cents a dollar in those days, because I'll be 62 in October. So at the time, the confluence of all of these sociological events, say 2001 until now, I've become very much interested in what's happening to European people, and anti-reality type of events seem to be controlling our destiny. So I began to become extremely active in studying that, and it still interests me. So now, really, James, all I've done is talk for some few years. I was in Estonia. I had a 5-year financial visa with a small inheritance of $85,000 from my grandmother, and I had hoped to spend pretty much the rest of my life there. But it didn't work out because I think the EU and other powerful personages saw that I was making podblock.com, which is a video site having to do with white nationalism, essentially. And I had begun that just 2 years after YouTube, that is in 2007, early 2007. And it was making a big impact. I would say we had millions of hits, and particularly many in the Nordic countries. So I was convicted in absentia by the Kingdom of Sweden for some sort of hate crime. And I read that Linder said, hate is like affirmative action for white people, hate crimes, because most hate crimes are committed by blacks upon whites. And there's a lot of drama surrounding that. I don't know what detail you want.
Well, I'm actually more interested in at this point in the transition from somebody who's merely curious about things that are going on. I mean, there are a wide variety of political stances and sort of working hypotheses that people pursue that are considered maybe fringe, but they're not the kind of thing that can actually bring down the total wrath of the mass media the way it's been happening over the last week or so with you. And somebody might say, oh, well, the Bilderbergers, or the Council on Foreign Relations is a problem, or the corporations, or the whatever, right? All these various things that we can go through in being sort of interested or concerned citizens, there's a range of ideas that really are outside the acceptable thought. In other words, it's not just that you might be a little kooky or something like that, talking about UFOs or something. It's like morally reprehensible to hold certain working hypotheses. And there was some point at which you went from merely exploring the range of opinion to crossing that border. And that border is inculcated into us. I mean, it's not, you had to be aware of the fact that you were crossing into forbidden territory, right?
In the course of my lifetime, yeah. I once saw Savitri Devi in Bangalore, India, at Satya Sai Baba's ashram, and I was kind of a wallflower in those days, and I thought it was enough to have her darshan, but I had already read her for several years now. And then I lived in Hawaii a long time, and I had an experience in a culture in which I was not, my race was not in control, and although the experiences ran the gamut of kindness to out and out being beaten up on the public streets, I came to conclude that really this is not natural. So, and I'm not at a certain point, I joined World Church of the Creator, James, because I'd read Ben Clausen, and I understood that some of that was subsuming into one fell swoop the First Amendment religious and speech freedom, and doing away with the anti-reality of there being a supreme being, and particularly a Jewish one, and his son. And that helped. So I've been stalked by the Southern Poverty Law Center, in my opinion, and the Anti-Defamation League, and now currently in this environment, SLAT, which is the State and Local Anti-Terrorism Training. And it's a governmental organization in which, for example, Mark Pickavage has received $2 million way back in 1999, which was really the inception of public internet, pretty much. There wasn't much broadband then. And to my mind, these are Jewish civilian spy organizations that keep an eye on European Americans. And they've done it probably with Mossad, because Viktor Ostrovsky, who wrote three books about his experiences in Mossad, said in a video, and I have that on podblank.mobi, that they used to call up from New York to Mossad and tell them who to defame. Vice versa, I guess the communications obviously went both ways. Mossad sometimes would. Sometimes I'm sure ADL had autonomy. And then I think the way the hierarchy goes is from ADL to SPLC. I highly suspect that. And, of course, there was the proven confederate at Elohim City, which was Andreas Strassmeyer. That's been proven by the Louis Free memo. Lately, just the media deluge, it's very odd, because I'm one man out here in a very old house. In 1951 it was made. Actually, I even have an outhouse. And
well, getting back to the point of time when you crossed the line that's been set up by what I call the moral zeitgeist, the moral zeitgeist being the spirit of the age sets certain parameters on not just what is considered to be rational thought, but what's considered to be moral thought, okay? And you're saying that your experience in Hawaii in particular, and you also visited India, is that correct?
Yeah, I've been to India several times.
Okay.
And when I was young, I was obsessed with reading Krishnamurti and Vivekananda and Ramakrishna and Air Baba and Gurdjieff and Ouspensky and Madame Blavatsky and Annie Besant. It really ran the gamut.
Right. So during, just in the normal course of exploring the range of ideas and opinions that you were very interested in, you, in addition to having an experience of a multicultural, multiracial environment in Hawaii, were quite drawn to India, where there's a variety of alternative zeitgeists, I guess I'd say. In other words, there are different ideas about morality and the place of race and the relationship between the southern races and the northern races, which came into confluence in India in a very interesting way. So there was some point in time when, in addition to the experience that you had in Hawaii, where you had the experience of being what, maybe not a strict minority, but on the way there, you also experienced India, a lot of the diversity of zeitgeists that are available in India. Did you experience India after or before Hawaii?
Before, much before. Okay. I went there the first time when I was 21 years old.
Okay, and then when you went to Hawaii, how old were you?
27,
okay. So when you went into Hawaii, this multicultural environment, you had already encountered a pretty radically different way of viewing morality, I'll put it that way.
Yes, I traveled, I'd been around the world.
Right. So far from being some kind of, I guess the way a lot of these people would like to portray white nationalists is that they're country bumpkins who are not really aware of the world, and they're sort of hung up on their guns and whatever in an isolated sense. And that was actually the opposite of what happened. You actually left Missouri and explored not just ideas from your homestead of Missouri, but you actually traveled and lived in other cultures and experienced them directly. So this provided you with a range of experience. Did you find yourself becoming more racially aware before you hit Hawaii, or was it really as a result of the combination of India and Hawaii that you crossed that line in the moral zeitgeist of the West?
It was definitely before, because even in high school I had given speeches for George Wallace. But then in subsequent years, many times, given the social situations, I would try to go along to get along. I also lived in the Arctic, Canadian Arctic, several years, and I made several trips up there for a total of several years. And I lived with Indians and Eskimos and oil workers. So I think my multicultural experience was very vast. In fact, for a time, I had lived in those kind of societies longer than I had lived in Missouri or in Boston. And also, even when I got to Hawaii, I'd read Chögyam Trungpa for years, 6 years then, by the time, for example, I think probably a lot of your listeners would know him. And one anecdote that I could tell you in India, I remember in Bangalore, an octogenarian, the lady I'm sure was over 80, she told me she was. And so in 1970, she would have been born in 1890. And she stood there and really kind of lectured me in a nice way and stuck with me all these years that she was an Aryan. She wanted me to know that. And she had light, light gray eyes. She said, I am from North India. I'm not from here. And she was in a sari and very well educated. I forget if a British accent or not, probably. And that made a big impact on me, little simple things like that. And I began to study the Kushans and the Yuzis.
Well, going back to, I'd like to talk a little bit about George Wallace, because, I we're close to the same age. I'm 59. You're a couple of years older, I guess. But growing up in the 60s, during basically my childhood and early adolescence, it was very clear to me what was required of me morally by the wider culture. Although I was being brought up in a fundamentalist Christian church, it was a Nazarene church, the Christianity at that time was being replaced in my mind with what I would call Holocaustianity, basically the one Jewish myth for another Jewish myth, regardless of the, I'm sorry?
Fantastical. The second secular and the first fantastical.
Well, the Holocaust is portrayed as something that's sort of beyond the normal secular event by Holocaustianity. In other words, it's this incomprehensible sacrifice of the innocent light unto the world. Jews are the innocent light unto the world, and they were crucified by Hitler, is the essential tenor of the myth. And I was... I didn't have the entire idea of the Holocaust at that time, but it was very clear to me what kind of morality I was expected to adopt, and I pretty much adopted it. I mean, it was the thing that sort of saved me was the fact that by being brought up in a fundamentalist Christian environment with this, relatively irrational acceptance of this compendium of writings, ancient writings that had gone through who knows how many editors as the Word of God, it was just, obviously it was something that was easy to slough off. And, just from a simple rational thought basis. And in the process of doing that, I became aware of the psychology of morality and the way people are indoctrinated, and then they get stuck in this sort of moral environment where they're not being rational. And then as I was being converted into a Holocaustian, I saw the same kinds of psychological characteristics in the people around me who were supposedly rational and cosmopolitan. So that's what saved me. And in your case, I mean, and actually I didn't I didn't actually come to this kind of, I guess, immune response to the secular religion or to the new theocracy until somewhat later. I was always relatively outside the normal herd, but I did not, for example, stand up for George Wallace in high school the way you did.
That's what I wanted to ask. If as a young prodigy there in Iowa, if you were a Wallace backer.
No, I wasn't. I mean, I wasn't against Wallace. It was more like not amoral, but it was just I was in a completely different space because of the fact that I was required to adopt a very rational and reasonable approach to things, and it just took a long time for me to get enough information to sort of see what was going on. But in your case, it sounds like you had some idea that there was a need for states powers, if you will, to stand up against central authority so that there could be some diversity of thought in the laboratory of the states. Is that incorrect, or what was your basic stance toward George Wallace in high school, and where did it come from?
Well, as I recall, that was 1968, and at that time, I was in a high school. At that time, I hadn't been to the Boston High School, and so I'd just come back. That's right, I would have at that time. In any case, here's the thing about George Wallace. The cities had been burned, when was it, 66 and 67, 65 too, I think.
Yeah.
And these horrific riots all over. I see the younger people who listen. It's in my living memory, so... Mr. Wallace sounded to a lot of people in the country eminently sensible, although these days not so many people would cross those social bounds that you've mentioned.
Okay, so at the time, basically, it wasn't the moral zeitgeist boundaries on thinking about races having identity. I mean, the white race having a legitimate identity wasn't as immoral, or wasn't the boundary against that wasn't as well established in the 60s. It was being established in the 60s. Is that correct?
I remember I gave speeches for Wallace in speech class, and I remember having big placards. I had a 65 Pontiac Catalina my father bought me. It was real nice, white and blue interior, fastback, and I had Wallace huge ones all over the windows, and my friends would just laugh and laugh, and they'd get in and say, let's drive around. And sometimes we would literally drive over the city. They got the biggest kick out of it. And
right.
No, the adults didn't say take those off or spit or anything like that.
But
and I just wanted to mention, James, to back before Wallace, when I was 10 or 11, I used to look at Life and Look magazine. And again, for younger people, this is how communications were made in those days. We didn't obviously have the internet. It sounds really trite to say that. And so I would stare at Rudolf Hess's Spandau. I feel emotional even remembering it. And I thought, there's something going on here, because I've read about all these great wars in human history being a boy. How can this old, frail little man, why would they spend all this money? I saw things in a real logical way to me. I thought, it's pecuniary. Why would they waste this money? I'd ask all the adults and everyone, and no one could give me an answer. And every time they'd come out with a spread on Spandau, I'd be fascinated.
Okay, so in the 60s, there was a combination of a nascent moral zeitgeist that would basically become, ethnic masochism on the part of Europeans. But that wasn't established very well at the time, plus the fact that you were curious enough about what was going on in the world that you started picking up on things that looked like they were part of the taboo of the previous moral zeitgeist, which included vilification of the Nazis, not only in the normal sense that you would vilify an enemy, but tracking them down. In other words, you're talking about, you said Rudolf Hess in Look magazine?
Yes.
I'm sorry?
No, he was in Spandau for many, many years, a huge whole prison devoted to himself.
Oh, okay.
You see? And
Those memories, and you know, the Christianity thing, which you mentioned in your family, I also didn't understand that. If I would have, I could have, I suppose, but I just didn't believe it, and it scared me because, on some level, if you didn't converse about it, at least with some people, they didn't like you in general. And I also, my father was a very charismatic, successful businessman, and I think later in life, even my going to India, I sort of transcribed charismatic, powerful, older male figure to the concept of enlightenment, which sounds awfully silly now. You know, I'm an older man, I guess you could say old man. And I regret it, having spent so much time. And now I see it as a longing to have a strong European leader.
And, well, when you say enlightenment, what do you mean?
Well, you know, I thought if people like Buk de Hooty and Bach and Haydn could, when I heard that music in the churches, and you know, it's not as if I was culturally deprived, but in a way it was like that because my family was upper middle class and I longed for a lot more intellectual stimulation. The fact that such great geniuses somehow were subservient to Christ or God impressed me. And I thought there had to be a reason they did that. Now, I didn't understand that it's just social mores was a great deal of it, you know? It's like being, if you were Hieronymus Bosch, for example, I'm sure the neighbors in those days, he had some grief. But I thought maybe our culture had become stale, that is, that we'd lost the spiritual way. And this was pushed pretty heavily in the late 60s, mid-60s to early 70s. So I thought perhaps there's such a thing as enlightenment, Satori or Zazen, Samadhi, and that if one could achieve even a close level, you know, I started to read all this nonsense about seven chakras and seven levels of understanding and the fourth way, for example, things like that. Could you just, and it was very impressive to me. And so I went to India thinking that there was such a charismatic teacher or teachers there who could make me come along. In other words, if one could spiritually gain, and by spiritual I mean almost solve this mysteries of this appearance and consciousness, I could serve other sentient beings and then as well, as they say, solve the mystery of life. I mean, that seemed so much more important to me than, for example, making a great deal of money as my father did, or even trying to become a billionaire. I thought, what is the most important thing one can do with life? And it's ironic that trying so hard, I failed in that sense.
So, well, thanks for describing enlightenment. That was my question. You're speaking of enlightenment, not in the Western terms of the enlightenment, but in the Eastern terms of spiritual enlightenment. Before you took off on that journey, there was some kind of transition from basically saying that George Wallace had something important to say to seeking a completely foreign culture. And in a lot of people's minds, you know, a 60s Wallace supporter seeking enlightenment in India is completely incongruous. Do you understand?
Certainly, I understand.
Okay, so there's a transition that occurred here that has something to do with the late 60s that you referred to. There was something about questioning the basis of Western culture.
Yes.
That came to fore in your mind. What can you go into that a little bit more? What you mean by that? You said that there were these great geniuses that, because of their sort of the social milieu in which they were steeped, were subservient to this mythology. It was really alien to their culture. I mean, the Mid-Eastern Judeo-Christian religion.
And yet they produced works that were far greater than I could hope to in my life.
Right. But there was something about the incongruity of the subservience of these geniuses to this seeming superstition in your mind that caused you to depart from, or actually sort of, I guess, progressed perhaps from being a Wallace supporter to being a seeker of spiritual enlightenment in India?
Yeah, I tried to read things I couldn't fully understand when I was pretty young, 16. You know, Kierkegaard and Heidegger and Kant and Nietzsche and Will to Power. I understood that a little better for some reason. Uh-huh. And it's a logical progression to read the Eastern works after that, especially in my generation. It was all Hermann Hesse. We read Hesse a lot, and I read everything I think Hesse wrote. In fact, I used to have his autograph on a page of a document he had written.
So basically, it sounds like what happened with you was more or less similar to what happened to me, in that there was a point where you simply had transcended the moral Zeitgeist, and basically because of your commitment to your personal spiritual integrity, you had to non-align, you know, become non-aligned, and leave all of the herds behind and sort of seek out for yourself. There was, of course, during that period of time, there was a sort of resurgence of interest in the Indian subcontinent in the popular culture because of the Beatles.
Yes.
Did that play any role?
You know, it must have. I'd have to stop and think, James. I'm sure Jai Guru Deva, nothing's going to change my world, and particularly Harrison's going. But by the time the Maharishi thing came, excuse me, that was 66. So I guess, the first book I remember I read was Paramahansa Yogananda. And you know, all these dilettantes, these things have been kicking around, especially when I was young. They would be sometimes hardcovers in first edition. I'm speaking of things like Vivekananda and Annie Besant. And I would roam these bookstores to find them. So yeah, the Beatles may have had some influence.
But the Beatles weren't promoting those particular lineages. So there was something that led you to those lineages that must not have been the Beatles, per se. What was the first Indian subcontinent lineage that you recall being interested in?
Let me think about that. It may have been a Ramakrishna, which was, I believe, Vivekananda's teacher.
What led you to that?
It's probably a book I chanced upon, other than Yogananda. It sounds pretty silly. I don't know if our listeners want to, you know, find this. It does to me in retrospect, if you don't mind my saying. But it is what it is.
Well, but you were just sort of, you know, in a state of searching, and you just happened upon a book that you picked up for some reason that you don't really recall why it was you chose that book. Is that correct?
That's basically it. I think it was Ramakrishna, and from there to Vivekananda, his student. But the thing about Ramakrishna is, to tell you, one thing is, they said he would sit there and glow. I may have that right. Excuse me, maybe I'm thinking Ramana Maharshi. It's been so many years since I've read this book. You know, Ramakrishna, for example, he was more modern, but I guess they would go by for his darshan, they would say. And they would say, just having the vision of someone with this spiritual level would, by some sort of magic waves, I'm being a little condescending, but that's really basically it, affect your being and consciousness. And it's terribly embarrassing to talk about this. And even Savitri Devi, who I'd been a big fan of, to see her there at Sai Baba's and know that she had written so beautifully about Hitler, what's that about?
You became familiar with Sai Baba, and then the association with Satori Devi led you to read her works, which once again put you into contact with this sort of incongruous treatment of the Nazi era by the Western media.
But I'd read Savitri Devi for several years before I saw her in 73 in April. I'd read her for several years.
Right. Okay, well, I wanted to go into that in some depth. You know, the late 60s were a particularly intense period of transformation of the moral zeitgeist, and you were undergoing a transformation that a lot of people might have difficulty identifying with, you know, going from being a Wallace supporter to being interested in spiritual lineages in India. And then out of that, of course, you come back to Hawaii and Hawaii is sort of an exceptional demographic state in the United States and geographically unique. So all of this led you to be outside of the normal herd instinct for the way people see what the bounds of acceptable behavior are.
Now, even though I've always had a hard time figuring it out, I did at a certain point begin to take psychotropics, and I suppose that affected my brain.
That's an important aspect of that era, too. So could you go into that a little bit, or would you prefer not to do that?
I don't mind to talk about it. I haven't too much. I know I have before briefly with you or a few others.
Do you think that was important to you?
It was useful. Okay. You know, I've even read, I'll just tell you one historical anecdote. I've read that the Russian nobles, the wealthy people, they would, I don't know if it's true, it sounds a little bizarre, but they would piss off the balcony and the peasants would try to catch their urine to get the psychedelic. I mean, it has a long thing in human history, a long history and story. So a lot of people may or may not understand these days. But I did take LSD a number of times. I think I took STP, what was alleged to be, once. And
in what way do you think that it was useful?
It allows you to feel an intensity of being in a moment that it's hard to avoid the moments, as normally in life people are able to do. That's maybe a poor description. And
I think before we go much further, we should talk a little bit about the dangers of this stuff, because especially, you know, we're not in the same world now that you were in then.
No.
Timothy Leary, for all of his flaws and defects, did at least talk about the importance of set and setting, mm-hmm, in establishing an appropriate use of these kinds of psychotropics. What was the set and setting in which you took these? In other words, the set is sort of the mental attitude that you take into the experience, and the setting is the environment within which you take it. It's the inner and outer environment, if you will. Can you describe that?
Let me think. The first time, well, some of the memorable times were in Montreal in a basement apartment that was a very luxurious apartment for the time. I mean, very, very well appointed, very upper middle class, and very strong in historical architecture, like a mini castle. So I had an apartment in the basement, and it was very well appointed. And I remember quite a few experiences there. It was something.
And so the environment in which you took it was 1960s Montreal?
Well, 1970. And I'll just tell you, I remember one time there was a lot of what was called purple microdot, in which you talk about purity, and orange barrels. But I believe it was Owsley Stanley. I mix up his name and Stanley Owsley, and it's just an anecdote. But years later, in the mid-80s, in San Rafael, California, I worked for an answering service. We had Father Guido Sarducci and the Grateful Dead. I'd talk to them every day. And then we had Owsley Stanley. I think it's Owsley first and then Stanley. But one time, because the owner of the answering service was an old San Francisco acid queen, she said, "Would you like to meet Bear?" I said, "Okay." And he came in, and he was making these enamel and gold Grateful Dead heads, because he made their drugs, and I got to meet Owsley Stanley. I enjoyed that. So I told him, "Thank you very much for all your help."
So the environment that you took it in, one of the environments was relatively well appointed, circa 1970 Montreal, and that of course Montreal at that point in time was almost purely European.
Yes.
The culture was very much actually Western European. You were also in a relatively sheltered economic situation, not you personally, but the environment within which you were taking it was one that would be sort of illicit feelings of economic security.
Yeah, I can tell you an anecdote about that. One of the fellows I took a lot of it with is... he's now a psychiatrist. His name is Dr. Martin Beck of Ottawa. sister Kathy, and she has a PhD. And the third one at the time in that family was Beverly. I didn't know her very well at all, but she was a Maoist, she and her husband. So this was another thing going on in that era. Maoism, which is kind of like Jewish communism for Chinese people.
Right.
She eventually ended up with a PhD as well. I'm the only one that stuck with
okay. All. So the setting and that you were in was pretty much typical of what a lot of people had, which was a relatively cloistered. I mean, to the extent that people were promoting multiracial diversity in localized areas, integration and the like, it was in general pretty much from a standpoint of ignorance of the actual environment that it creates.
Yes. And there were Chinese restaurants in Montreal, and I knew some in one place I lived later on when I didn't have as good a circumstances as that luxury apartment. There were some Trinidad fellows, I remember, and they invited me down to party, and I remember them being sort of careless and a little loud.
Did you take any psychotropics in that environment?
Oh my God, I didn't, James.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing is, this is kind of important because, like I said, these things are dangerous. Okay, and people need to understand the importance of the set and sitting. See, if you're a young man today, and you know, you decide that you're going to try to free yourself in some sense from the mental bonds that the moral zeitgeist have placed upon you, taking psychotropics in the environments that are present today is a very different kind of experience, and it could be quite dangerous in certain circumstances. I would imagine, to you know, more so than the environments that were present in 1970. Not that I'm trying to say that your experience wasn't valuable. I believe that it was, and I think it was valuable for a lot of people in various ways back then. It's become more and more, I think, a dangerous thing because of the fact that the environments in which people are taking them are so alien to their evolutionary environments. I mean, you know, we all races evolved in monocultural environments. And so our natural neurology is not very well adapted to these wildly cosmopolitan situations. So let me see if I can pop the stack back to going to Hawaii from India to a multicultural environment in the United States. That experience led you to sort of see the future of America, I would imagine, in some sense. And at what point did you become a consciously racialist in the sense of saying, okay, well, we are now in a moral zeitgeist where I am outside the bounds of morally acceptable thought, but I'm pursuing this anyway out of a sense of individual integrity?
I think I was oscillating for many years in a sense. I saw some things internally, and I might speak to my closest friends about them. But in Hawaii in those days, the Japanese-American fellows who had been in the 442nd were only about, 25 years out from the war. They were just in their early to mid-50s. Those guys were samurai type, but yet they're radically leftist in Hawaii. I have a lot of understanding of that. I mean, so far left, I remember finding a book in a book sale by at La Ventriberia. Wow. I mean, a soft cover published in English way back when, I don't know, the 50s. And I noticed that there were exclusionary things about the society. It was virtually impossible to get a job, except in something like livery service for whites, unless you had advanced degrees, no matter how honest or hardworking. And all of the whites of my generation in Hawaii, the baby boomers, we knew this, and we talked about it amongst ourselves very openly. So those of us who stayed there many years, eventually the Jewish Linda Lingle ran for governor as a Republican, and then there was a fellow on the radio by the name of Rick Hamada, who's Japanese and Filipino, and he's very conservative. I remember calling him up and said, Rick, have you ever seen New Nation News? Of course, that was spanning a couple of decades there, James. But I began to, in Hawaii, certainly if you live in an area which is majority not of your race, whatever your race is, you're going to get it. So even the people who are minorities in our society feel some of this, I'm sure. Mm-hmm.
So your experience in Hawaii was that of a working class white as a minority, essentially, with the relationship that's now emerging in wider America, where you, if you're an upper class white and you have a lot of money, then, you know, you're in a very different world than the working class whites. So that was a very early experience of what has now a pervasive phenomenon in wider America. Your own background, however, was upper middle class. In other words, if you had not taken off, well, actually, I suppose I should ask, at this point, had you been pretty much disowned by your family? Okay. So you were disowned not really so much because of the fact that you adopted a racialist stance, but because of the fact that you had simply chosen out of a matter of personal integrity to pursue a route that was really more spiritual. And
I think I consistently broke too many taboos, and I would have done better if I could have understood how to.
Right.
By their Muslims, by what they wanted.
So that's, in a sense, you had become a fallen limousine liberal. I mean, I don't know that your father was liberal, but my point is that, you know, nowadays, if you're wealthy, then, you know, you're basically expected to be, if not a limousine liberal, then sort of a Republican who's going to have lots of third world labor, you know, quasi-slave labor, and, you know, hold in contempt the working class white.
You know, years later, James, when I saw my dad, and in fact, it was a year or two, let me see, it was a year or two before he died, and he was reduced and didn't know who the president of the United States was. And he told me he had some apartments open. And my grandmother didn't want me to rent to blacks. She was pretty vociferous about it, which is really odd because she could play the organ, and she was very well, very cultured, really the most cultured person in her family. And my father really said the same. He said, here's what you do. You ask him for a financial report. I said, okay, Dad. Don't worry, I'm not going to, Dad. I'm a creator. But the funny thing is one time one fellow came and he had just gotten out of prison. He had been a murderer. And I asked him for the financial report. I know that worked. And then in the same time, James, my dad said he thought blacks had to work harder for everything than everybody. That was it for everything. They had to work harder. Even sports, you know, and I said, well, that doesn't make sense if they have the gift for sports. But then, too, he was an extremely high Mason, I mean, the highest you can get.
Okay. So that would tend to, in the present-day environment, he would be sort of a traditional conservative, or I shouldn't say traditional, but what's become sort of the neocon type of open borders, bring in the slave labor, you know, we'll go ahead and spread the good graces of the West to the unenlightened portions of the world by Judeo-Christian war or whatever.
Well, one time he was in San Antonio building million-dollar houses, and he had a few of those when he passed away. And I remember calling him up and said I'd come and work for $5 an hour. Sorry, son, don't have any work for you. And now that I look back on it, he was probably paying Mexicans $2 an hour or something at that time.
Yeah. So that's pretty typical. For me. So okay, so your family situation was sort of a microcosm of what happened to the nation of settlers as a family. This bifurcation, betrayal of the earlier generation and their ensconced economic state with the subsequent generations and their dispossessed state. So I guess I understand now, like many people were during the 60s, searching for a different moral compass, if you will, provided a period of relative intellectual freedom that you could generally find things that would not later on become findable, but simply because of the fact that the moral compass had been sort of reoriented from, like I said, from Christianity to Holocaustianity, and once again thought was locked down. I guess let's back up to Hawaii and talk a little bit about Hawaii and your development there. At what point in Hawaii did you realize, or did you realize in Hawaii that it was necessary to adopt a position that was going to be running counter to the general culture?
Midwest, are overly polite, I think now it's hard for me to get away from it. It's maybe incongruous to many people that I can be in person so soft-spoken and polite and intermediate such.
If I may provide my own interpretation of that, like you've been having these guys from the New York Times come in and various other places that have their own opinion of you as demon-possessed, right? And that's as much of a prejudice as they accuse you of having, but they apply it, maybe they're actually more prejudiced than you are in terms of, you know, individuals, is my interpretation of a lot of that. So describe the couple that they sent in from the New York Times to interview you yesterday.
Kind of a two-headed gargoyle, a monster. It was a black naturalized American, age 30, from Trinidad. His name was John Elegon, I believe. I have his card right here. And a blonde with light blue eyes from Minnesota. She drove in. He flew to Bismarck in Kansas City. So he had long, kinky hair down halfway down his back, and he was tall and thin. And she had very, very light blue eyes and was blonde. And
so, I mean, this is not, you know, your typical New York Times reporter. I mean,
no.
they obviously sent this combination in for a reason. It's pretty obvious what the reason is from an emotional standpoint. They were trying to provoke you.
Even the, when was it, 64, 65, whenever it was, interview of George Lincoln Rockwell by Haley, the guy who wrote Roots. That was real controversial in those days. I remember that. So, yeah, that's the Jewish technique.
Well, actually, this brings to mind something that I've sort of observed from time to time with people trying to get them to understand something about human mm-hmm. ecology, which is, it's not just human ecology, it's sex. If you look at the geography of Y chromosomes, in other words, the male chromosomes, versus the geography of the female chromosomes, the mitochondrial DNA, it is apparent that the Y chromosomes are very strongly geographically correlated. In other words, you'll have relatively small regions in which you have a particular Y chromosome that's clearly dominant. And the female chromosomes tend to be much more spread out. And this tends to follow with other species too, which indicates that there is a relative mobility of females across boundaries, across territorial boundaries relative to males. So when they send in if they had sent in, for example, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed male and a Trinidad female, it would have had a different sort of visceral impact on you. Okay, well, I should say it would on me. Okay, it would still be obvious that it was contrived. And it would be obvious that it was compared to our evolutionary environment of, you know, tens of thousands of years, very unnatural. But nevertheless, it would not be the kind of provocation that is so typical of modern day sort of, I'd have to call it genocidal culture, the genocidal culture against Europeans by Holocaustianity. It really tends to focus on the foreign male invading the territory of the European male. I don't know if this is something that's ever occurred to you, but it's really obvious looking at different species and the way female mobility relates to, you know, contrasts with male mobility. Male aggression is now characterized in humans as hate, is a sexual characteristic. In other words, if you have a male coming in that's outside the territory, he will tend to encounter hate across all species. So we are undergoing what amounts to a very inhumane treatment. The civilization is treating humans in a very inhumane way compared to what a good zookeeper would treat his charges, understanding the nature of male aggression and mating patterns. Having said that, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about territory, such as the one you're trying to set up in Leith. you talked a little bit about the fact that you wanted to get people who, of course, have like minds and some leadership people and others of that nature. But simply, it seems that as though even having a really small little territory that is identified with masculine European, I should say, instincts, is considered to be really a profound threat. The Southern Poverty Law Center, POTOC, said that this was one of the most advanced, yours was one of the most advanced projects in terms of dangerous ideology that you'd run across. And, you know, this seems to be absolutely crazy, given the fact that you've gotten nobody to move there.
Right. I mean, just waiting for people to do what I've done.
Yeah, I mean, all you've done is you've gotten a few lots and you've invited people to join you. And part of the puzzlement here is, I mean, you've been talking about this for what? You've been talking openly for over a year, since a year ago last May or March?
It has been a year. It's been, I think, about 8 months since I actually announced the location that this is Leaf. Before I gave hints, I gave geographic hints. I think I said, oh, it's...
Okay, at what point did you publicly mention Leith?
I believe it was 8 months ago.
It wasn't last Thursday. When did the SPLC reporter show up in Leith?
Sometime before last Thursday, which was the 22nd of August.
Okay. So this is months. This is months after it was available, public knowledge, that you were in Leith doing this. So it's kind of curious that, and of course, the SPLC reporter showing up is what then set off this I can only call it a media frenzy that's now burgeoning to the point where the New York Times is sending out a provocative duo trying to get you to react in some way that they can capitalize on, I would guess. Do you have any idea what might have triggered the SPLC to do what they did last week as opposed to 8 months ago?
Well, I know for one thing that they use Hate Watch as a cash register jingler, so that's part of it.
Are you saying that maybe the SPLC was just having, you know, trying to do a fundraiser?
Well, I think that's in the mix. But it also is for them to come here when there are 22 people or something. My friend was here for a while. He actually worked in a frac sand company with me. And when he left, I guess the... neo-Nazi population declined by 50%.
So was he a neo-Nazi?
Well, he was an aide to Tyndall. I suppose and Tyndall wasn't he associated with Oswald Mosley when he was young?
So. Okay, but you're using neo-Nazi in the sense that of the way that the SPLC characterizes you.
Yeah, in comedy term, like that. Okay. Kind of like Blazing Saddles does.
What's right, name? Okay. Because I understand you characterize yourself as a creator. What's the distinction in your mind between I suppose the word neo-Nazi is difficult to define, given the fact that the way they use it seems to bear no correlation with anything except for, like I was saying, you know, male, European masculinity.
I don't think it's in the dictionaries yet. In Nature's Eternal Religion and the White Man's Bible, there are mentions of Hitler and the Third Reich and National Socialism. And obviously we knew that they were fighting for our people on some levels, or more than some level, I think. I think it's fair to say. And so, yes, I like some things about them. And because of my natural understanding of Indian and the Vedas, the horse Veda and all that, and the history of Taxila and the Afghanistan area and all of these... The Greco-Indian Grecos and Western satraps. I like the Swazi, and I have also even that from a pretty young age. But to me, I just see them as part of our people's cultural history. I'm glad that those fellows fought in the Arctic Circle. I actually knew two fellows who'd been in the German army. One of them was in the 12th Waffen at the end when the kids were out in the forest around the time of the Battle of the Bulge, and there were officers from the Eastern Front. So I knew him in the Arctic around 71, and at the time he was, I think, 42 or 3. His name was Carl Sorter. He was an electrician in a construction company in which I was the expediter and payroll clerk, and then the other fellow used to clean a large bar. He was older and So there's some of that, James. I mean, some of it's just normal stuff in my life. But, you know, people will have this, people listening to this now who are very young will remember this when they're old, maybe, parts of it.
The identification with Nazi, when you say that, you know, comedic term of neo-Nazis, you know, it's far from comedic from the sense that this is the label that's applied, sort of the way, you know, if you have a bee swarm, if you have a beehive, and one bee will go and sting an enemy and sort of mark it with a pheromone so that the other bees come and attack. That's sort of what the neo-Nazi label has become. It's like a pheromone that's applied to a place that's, you know, like a laser designation for targeting. And then the swarm comes in, as it has over the last week in the media.
And, when we discussed it the other day, I compared it to Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery, and without going into the story, if people are curious, they can read it, but it's very strange, and the Jews have the need to discourage any nascent white gathering, even while they bring in just literally tens of millions of Mexican illegals, and they transfer and build entire city blocks of blacks. And now there's a recent program in which they're going to extend just every single ville and right down to Leith, I suppose. In fact, gosh, Leith might be one of the first after this, in which they jigger the racial numbers in every single community. They're going to try to jam that down people's throats in this country. It's really bizarre and frightening.
Well, yeah, maybe I could talk a little bit about the rhetoric of violence, the rhetoric of hate, because that's been criminalized in a large portion of the West, right? In other words, if you basically talk about...
a lot of people in jail in Germany...
In my estimation, when you've got people who are being subjected to experiments to which they did not consent, it's aggression. The Nation of Settlers of the United States was... by the virtue of the Immigration Act of 1965 and also the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which removed private discretion, in effect, from a lot of your personal relationships that you would establish. Mm-hmm. You know, people were subjected to a social experiment that they did not consent to. And what is generally used as an excuse for wrapping that up is that people at the time that those things happened didn't come out and basically declare, you know, the government to be illegitimate and have a revolution. Of course, you know, people are off trying to, you know, raise their families and make ends meet, and they can't pay attention to things that are going on in Washington and a variety of other centralized locations. So it's easy to put things over on people. When you're treated as an experimental subject and you didn't really provide your consent, and then this experiment proceeds to have its effects on you, and then you react out after the fact, and then you're denounced for having a reaction to having this experiment performed on you. It's a perfectly obvious reaction for a male to react to being experimented on without consent. In a way that's obviously against natural patterns of migration, i.e. foreign males being, you know, imposed by force, by government force, on local males. The response of violence and hatred is obviously almost a necessary response if you're going to retain your masculine character. So that's one of the reasons why people oftentimes point to things that you've said on Podblock and a lot of other things that people have said in terms of hate and using epithets, racial epithets, you know, calling people niggers, mud people, mud sharks, whatever, as indicating that you essentially abrogate your own human rights. That's the excuse that the SPLC and the New York Times, etc., will use, that, you know, you are a danger because of the fact that you say these things, when in fact they are the ones who have engaged in this aggression and have the government force behind them. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to do that segue, just to indicate why it is that, you know, I am entirely sympathetic with anybody basically out there who is engaged in any kind of reaction, because I see them as tortured animals. know, this is pure torment that's going on the males of European origin, and a lot of them react by simply abandoning their masculine identity, which is a large part of what's going on with the promotion of homosexuality, I think, and why homosexuality is so acceptable to the regime, because it's a way of essentially giving up territory, and that's what it boils down to, is it's a play for territory. So, having said that, I wanted to talk a little bit about, I don't know if you heard about this guy, but I guess it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, there was this guy, Ayo Kimathi.
Yes, the DHS employee.
Yeah, Department of Homeland Security, who is basically calling for a race war. He's a black guy. And I actually sent him an invitation to do an interview like the one we're doing last week. I'll just read what I sent him. It says, "Mr. Kimathi, I would like to conduct an audio interview with you for my podcast series, Sortocracy's Compassion. The topic would be your vision for the kind of society you would create and possible peaceful means for creating it. I have done no further podcasts since the initial ones last winter solstice because I wanted each podcast to provide high impact. If you listen to the first part, or listen to the first two podcasts, you'll get an idea of my agenda. I also have an extensive history of writings that are archived all over the internet since the 1980s, so you can check that history for consistency. Sincerely, James Bauer." He did not respond to this, which is one of the reasons why I'm going to be putting your interview up there instead of his. But an interesting fact about him is that he was in Department of Homeland Security, and he is now on paid leave from Department of Homeland Security. It's almost a coincidence that this came out, this whole thing about Ayo Kimathi came out as a result of a similar action by the SPLC. It looked like the SPLC triggered a sort of a media cascade, and they did this just prior to coming to investigate quote-unquote Leith, and then triggering out the media cascade there. I just find that interesting, that coincidence interesting, because of the fact that, you know, why last week would they send, after, you know, the location of Leith had been known for 8 months to the SPLC, why would they do it last week of all times? Was perhaps that triggered by Ayo Kimathi, or is Ayo Kimathi sort of like this, you know, a sock puppet? Do you know anything about this guy?
Just what I've read online. I hadn't considered that he might be. That's rather interesting.
Well, one of the things that is particularly interesting about him is that he is anti-lesbian, gay, bi, transsexual, LGBT. So one of the things that he's doing is he's denouncing the promotion of the homosexual agenda. That leads to me to believe that maybe he's, you know, for real, because that's not the kind of thing that a sock puppet from the SPLC would be doing. You know, a black sock puppet would tend to be doing, I wouldn't think, but I don't know. It's hard for me to get inside the heads of these guys. You were saying that the SPLC and the ADL are in some kind of hierarchical relationship. Who is in charge of who?
Well, I think the ADL is the more powerful organization. They have a high rise in New York City, and I think that they have assets well above $1 billion. And of course, the SPLC, they lost about $50 million in the Bernie Madoff scandal. And others have said that when you're getting the type of interest rates that bright money people know that Madoff was offering and paying, that you can be sure there's something crooked going on.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the media frenzy and basically just the phenomenology of how that unfolded beginning last week with the SPLC guy showing up. Can you talk about that?
Well, I was at work and I got fired, as I mentioned, and so that was the end of that.
Well, that was the first time. Really that was the first you found out about this.
That's the very first. In fact, Joe the Paver, who's been there, I think, 30 years, and he's raised 4 sons. He lives in Minnesota, and he's German descended, you know, a long time ago when I said this. The descent. And he comes over and puts his hand on my shoulder, he did, and said, "Paul, I want to tell you that the picture's in the paper." Right there I knew. Didn't have to say more, but I was waiting for the details. And
he gave me a little bit, and he said, the whole camp's talking about it. And then within about 40 minutes or so, Lori, another girl who's always real kind to me, she's one of the pros, and she brought over a three-page Xerox, and I guess it was being passed around. And the way it was written with hate crime, you see, they didn't know what the hate crime was. You know, did I grab a big fist-sized rock and hit, you know, bash somebody's head in? And they lost their brain waves. You know, what was it? And they wanted to know if I was, were you a mass killer or something? They literally asked me that.
Of course.
It seems silly, but
well, no, that's part of the gig with these terms like hate crime or racist or anything. They're connotation vehicles. They're vehicles of connotation, but not meaning.
Then they wanted all by and by. This is all in the space of 3 or 4 hours. They said, "Come up here and ride on the paver, Paul." And usually I don't do that. There's like a top deck. It's like Lord Nelson up there on the top, you know, because these people are pros. They've been doing it, you know, decades, many of them. And you know, you could stay there 6 years, and they'd say, "Oh, that guy didn't last long."
Well, let's be clear on something. Were you actively promoting racialist ideology among the workers?
No, nobody had a clue. In fact, my supervisor Cub, his name is Jared, but he goes by Cub, C-U-B, and he's a Nordic from a blonde guy from Minnesota. He said, "Paul, you're one of the nicest guys I've ever met." And he said, "If I meet you outside this place, we're going to be good friends." And I just can't believe it. It's the hardest thing I've had to do since I've been a boss in my employment history. And he said, "You show up on time, you never complain, and you do exactly what you're told."
We're talking, you know, again, working class whites that have been put under tremendous pressure from the standpoint of being able to even form families, both economically and, you know, in terms of their masculine identity with females and the empowerment of females to abandon their relationships. So these men have somehow, without you promoting your ideology at all, when you get fired, well, actually, at that point, you hadn't been fired, right? You had simply all of a sudden discovered your sort of notoriety, and there were questions about what, quote, hate crime, end quote, you had committed, which turned out just simply be speech in regimes where free speech is not allowed. At what point did you find out that you had been fired?
Cub and Chad. Chad was there's another supervisor who does the dirt work, and Cub's the paving guy. So they drove up. These are big, big jobs, by the way. They're $14, $15 million jobs that we're doing. So this is a money business. So they drove up and told me. And another thing I'd like to emphasize, James, is I remember in my sociology class in university, they taught me something about uneven cultural something. And what that means is someone might have an extremely high education but be poor. Or someone might be rich but not very well educated. And I'm one of those persons who's uneven like that, because what my job was, I would walk along adjacent with these fellows and hold the sign on the hot asphalt, sometimes 200 degrees, you know, kind of like I imagined myself like the guys who would hold the banners and walk next to the Roman legionaries. And sometimes I would drive pilot car too. I was very good at that because I'd been a cabbie so long. But these are very low jobs, James, and your listeners on the majority rights, a lot of them I know have advanced degrees. And then before that in Kalispell, I'd clean toilets and work the desk at a rooming house of like pensioners, you know, it was old 19th century with a grill, and I'd put on the tie when I wasn't cleaning the toilets. And they all said my work was excellent there too, but they found out I was a hater.
So that you were fired the same day as the article came out, is that correct?
Yeah, I was. And
okay.
That was all. And you know, it's a really good job because you could clear $1,200-$1,300 a week.
Good job from a working class white standpoint. Did you see much of an effort to bring in, say, Mexicans into displace the white working class?
Oh yeah, they're all over us. A lot of them have CDLs. They're driving. And what people must understand, they're massive, massive trucks, and the line just sometimes goes on seemingly endless all day long with 80-ton trucks with sand, with water, with pumps. Halliburton, they call them the Red Army. And it's just fantastic. It's like the Iraq War or something.
Okay, so there's a basically there's this major mobilization in the Bakken Range for economic reasons, and they just can't avoid hiring working class whites because of the fact that they just need them. There's so much work to be done.
And one thing St. James's, they all started hugging me. I mean, I'm not really a huggy person, but the girls did, and they started, and then the guys, I guess, followed them. And these people are all, I was the oldest one on the paver. There was one truck driver, 76. He's really hanging in there. And a couple of truck drivers might have been a year or two older than me, but even those guys were puffing on ciggies. They're not long for the world, I suppose. But I was the oldest on around the paver, so they're all hugging me and telling me, Paul, you're part of the family. And they call me Paul because I have to use that name, which is my legal name, and so is Craig. Because I've been stalked all over the world by the SPLC, but now if you Google Paul, you can find me too.
Right. What was the next sort of major event in the unfolding of this burgeoning media frenzy? I mean, you were fired, and then what happened?
I drove home. It's 88 miles away, and I put the air conditioner on, treated myself and my Festiva, and drove home. And Kevin, his name is Cedarstrom, and he lives right here in Carson, which is only 6 miles away, but he's a feeder for the AP. Now, later, a few days later, yesterday, in fact, Blake Nicholson, a more senior AP writer, came back for another story. Kevin himself has already been back twice, and he took the pictures of me in the red T-shirt in the white hat, which I like. He took some good photographs. And then they all came. But the articles were already in the newspaper, so when I got home, I opened my Air Mac and looked at them all. And I guess they've been on Glenn Beck, The Blaze, and on the Huffington Report and the Daily Kos and Russia Today and the Young Turks and I think MSN, I know MSN, quite a few more.
Right. And so the initial reports, what was the tenor of the initial reports?
Not too nice, actually, James.
Okay. So the people that actually, there was this echo chamber that was occurring with Huffington Post and the Young Turks, et cetera, that sort of, the original thing, of course, was the SPLC, and then you had the local newspaper show up, and then that precipitated your loss of employment. You had some guy from Carson come in that was an AP feeder that did an initial article for the AP. And then what was the next contact, with direct contact with the press that you had?
Well, let me see. I guess Lauren Donovan for the Bismarck Tribune, came back and she had written one of your first stories. So she came back to Leith, met me with a photographer, and he literally took over 200 pictures. I guess he's going to sell them to the SPLC. I really do believe there's a possibility of that. And that interview went on long. And then when that art piece came out, the very first sentence was basically something about a Molotov cocktail coming through my front window, which I think is kind of a harsh way to open an article.
Yeah.
About a guy losing his job because he likes to exercise the First Amendment.
Yeah.
So she came, and then one of these, let me see, yesterday was the busiest day because this guy Blake Nicholson from the Associated Press came, and he came back with Kevin Cedarstrom, but Kevin Cedarstrom was then kind of like the cub reporter compared to this guy, and he could, as I looked in his yellow legal pad, he was fluent in shorthand. I think I've seen one other male in my life that was that, and he was a reporter too.
So how can you describe the interaction with these reporters? What was their, demeanor?
The males, I have to say, I'd prefer to be so far interviewed by males than females. And, I waste a lot of breath on them, James. I tell them, I try to use humor and use a panoply of the information I have, and very little bits of it get out, almost nothing. Really.
Right. Well, they're editing things down for their editorial agenda. And then you had, in addition to the AP that came out, you had the New York Times reports that we talked about a bit. They were there for quite a while, weren't they?
I think two and a half hours. Actually, three, because they took pictures around town after we separated.
I see. So how in the world could they while away that much time interviewing you? What was going on?
Sometimes they kind of hector you. They ask Lauren wanted to know how many weapons I had, and I they're all registered. They're all the I-38DF, don't you worry. And then cars drove by, and she said, gosh, there are a lot of cars driving by here. And I said, don't worry, Lauren, I'll protect you. And, and you know, I was really trying to be – she's about my age or a little bit younger, and they're married, but, you know, they're blonde and they're kind of good looking. And for me, you know, if you're an old guy like me, I'm not saying for the guys listening 20 years old. But, so I felt sincere when I tell her that.
Yeah, I understand.
It's her worry, and this is how she returns my kindnesses. And,
yeah. So she actually, you think that she was sincere about her concern that she was voicing about the cars driving by?
Oh, yeah, she was sincere, and she knew I was, too. But then she'd keep asking it over and over and over. And then at the end of the interview, it was quite long, too, she said, Craig, she said, what do you think? She said, did you ever think it would end up like this? She says, here you are. You're 62 years old. You know, living in October. She says, do you have a house here? It needs paint. There's no water. She said, everybody in town wants you to move. And you've lost your job. Did you ever think it would end like this? What do you have to say? And if I would have thought quicker, I would say, just lucky, I guess. But I did ask her, I said, well, I've been to 29 countries, have you? And then I started naming them, you know, places like Brunei and Malaysia and India and Nepal. And I said, have you been there? No. Korea, Japan, Latvia, Estonia, Finland, Sweden, Germany. No, I hadn't been there. So, and she wrote a book about churches. Anyway, she did a real hack job on me, James.
Well, yeah, as you would expect. So at the present point in time, you have some additional media attention that's still coming your way.
Yesterday, there was, as I say, there was the AP and then the New York Times. And the black fellow, we walked all over town and had some experiences. And the blonde was really very relational. And she and I think, hit it off. I noticed a few times this darkness would cross her face. And it reminded me of reading Edgar Allan Poe's stories, the way someone's countenance would be altered. And it was mostly when I'd say things like anus surfer.
Yeah. Well, that's not exactly the kind of thing that you say as a pickup line.
Well, she said I had a lot of sayings that she didn't understand and she had to think about. But at other moments, she would be telling me about she didn't want children when I quizzed her about that. She said, I just don't want to do what's involved with raising them. She said she had a German husband, but, you know, German descended, and he's very quiet. And I thought, gosh, I wonder what he thinks about it driving around the block. And then the woman riding horses, she had a baby at one point, you know, a toddler. And I said, look, isn't that so beautiful? I think her name was Jen. She had a very brilliant smile. And sometimes I would talk to her instead of the Negro. John, here's his card. It was
So they were basically sent out to provoke you. Did you, part of the problem is you're old enough that it's just the hormones aren't there to, you know, get all that riled up about, you know, the visceral imposition on your territory of this.
This fellow was tall and skinny and taller than me, and I'm 5'10 and a half, and I'd say he was 6'1, 6'1, 6'1" and a half, something like that. So at one point, and he's got a long, like Chinese queue, you know, which is kind of hard to do, I would think, with that kind of hair. So I thought that was kind of different. And we were talking, I was talking that there are physical differences. Blacks have a faster patellar response than a cranium. And I said, maybe you haven't been told these things. And then I started talking about the frontal lobes. And for some reason, this talk really bothered him. And he started kind of hovering over me, and his eyes were squinting. And it looked like he had yellow sclera on his eyes. And he got very close. I would say he invaded my space, you know. And I thought, wow, am I going to get assaulted by a reporter from the New York Times and this pinch will pay off?
So it actually inverted. Yeah, obviously they did this to try to provoke you. And it sounds like you ended up provoking him.
Yeah, and then another question he was really fixated upon later in the interview was, what are you going to do? Because he said, if I'm afraid of anything. And I said, well, you know, if two carloads of niggers arrive from somewhere, and they've got automatic weapons sticking out all four windows, and I see them coming around the stop sign there, and I go, whoa, and they're blaring hip-hop. I go, whoa, you know, I'm outgunned here. And he said, what are you going to do then? And he asked what we would do in our town if that kind of thing occurred. And I said, well, it's legal to drive around with weapons loaded in your front seat in North Dakota, but I don't think it to have them sticking out the window is. And he said, well, what's your town going to do? So, well, they'd be arrested if they were doing that in our town, because in North Dakota, you can drive around with an open weapon in the daytime loaded in your car seat. That's fine, as long as it's visible, even a high-powered rifle. But right. You can't stick it out the windows.
Yeah, well, you know, if you flag somebody, as they call it in gun safety courses, you know, that's a real no-no, and it could be considered assault. You know, basically pointing a gun at somebody. So if it's sticking out the window, it's obviously flagging everybody that's going by.
So he seemed to be suggesting that it was absolutely preposterous.
In any event, there was a scenario that was presented with the New York Times Trinidad reporter of a carload of whatever races coming by with their guns sticking out. Did you bring up that scenario, or did he bring up that scenario?
I think I brought it up when he asked me, what would you do? Blacks came to this town. I said, well, you know, there's nothing we can do. I'm sure they're going to be, I'm not going to roll out the red carpet for them, but there's nothing we can do. And he said, well, would they yell at him, or what would they do? And, you know, he wanted to kind of escalate. And I actually brought that up, because I said, well, and that would be a case which I could imagine in which the town would have to intervene.
Right. So in other words, what he was trying to once again, figure out or get something out of you that he could use in the news report, which would indicate that you would be aggressive to what, you know, what in fact is an act of aggression if you have the government that is enforcing integration. This is a fundamental violation of the primordial contract between males and their sovereignty, you know, because, you know, males of all species will defend their territory. But he's trying to get within that context. Of course, if you actually try to do anything or say anything, that you could be portrayed as being somehow in the wrong, because you have implicitly agreed to their presence because the government allowed them in, when in fact you didn't.
I wanted to ask him the same thing, but if I were to go to Harlem or Roxbury you know, I just walk down the street very politely with my blonde hair and my glasses and, you know, the way I dress and business shirts, and say, excuse me, brother or sir, if you tell me I could get a good hamburger, it probably wouldn't be very long before I just get beaten in the head.
Right. And of course...
You know, maybe that's a little... It might be a little extreme, but, you know...
Right.
If I persisted in just trying to hang around day after day, I don't think it would be too awfully long before trouble came my way.
Right. And of course, that is a natural masculine response for territory, which, you know, is allowed in places like Harlem and East LA, but it's not allowed anywhere in the United States for people of European extraction, as evidenced by you taking off to a relatively abandoned territory of the United States, and a ghost town, and trying to hit, you know, even a few lots.
Well, one thing they don't like about it here, the Southern Poverty Law Center, ADL, and SLAP, is... like, people can have money here, and they can acquire it relatively rapidly. I think that really bothers them. And they're not enormous sums like Harvey Weinstein gets for making movies, you know. But the mayor of Williston said that the average income, you know, with a population of 25,000 central and 10,000 peripheral in that city, is $71,000 for a single. They said that a year ago this month.
Well, right. I mean, there's been this, over the last 40 years, there's been this progressive decimation of the white middle class,
right.
Bifurcating exactly. It into sort of like the uber class, which is surrounded by foreign toadies, and then this uber class is then holds in contempt what was formerly the middle class, and is now the underclass. And if there is any kind of opportunity to acquire what would be considered an actual middle class status again, it's obviously a profound threat.
Yeah, because, I saw one of the leftists. Yes, because, go ahead, I'm sorry.
But, well, I'm just saying, you know, this is one of the things that Machiavelli talked about in the discourses, is that it's very dangerous to let up on oppression once you've instituted it, because if you oppress people, there are going to be people around who are going to be complaining and resisting. And if you then relent in your oppression, the people mm-hmm. who you have oppressed will possibly identify with the betterment of their estate with those who were resisting the oppression. And that will mm-hmm. simply bring, instead of buying support, it will bring support to your enemies. So it's the kind of thing where once these guys have taken off after the middle class the way they have and you know, caused a demographic collapse of the whites by virtue of the making it virtually impossible to form a stable family. Mm-hmm. You know, this is really, I mean, you know, with the loss of tens of millions of people due to drops in fertility and degradation of the population, et cetera. This is a profound oppression. You can't even
admit. But they're terrified. They're terrified. They have their little government stipend check, and they have something like Stockholm Syndrome, or what you just mentioned, Machiavelli demarcated. And, for example, someone posted on one of these sites, it might have been a Young Turks video, it sounded like a leftist, and he said, I don't know how Cobb can buy all that property. He said, I can barely pay my rent. And all I've spent up here is about $8,600.
Well, right.
But I heard on the radio only a quarter of the people in the country have $3,000 cash or more. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, the net assets of, you know, well, if you look at things in terms of net assets, it's actually far worse even than income.
Yes.
You know, so, but my point is that, about Machiavelli, is that, you know, perhaps these guys like the SPLC and these other folks sort of instinctively recognize that mm-hmm. if you loosen the thumbscrews on working class whites at this point with something mm-hmm. like the Bakken Range, where they can, you know, get something that still isn't really where their parents, you know, were mm-hmm. in terms of risk-adjusted income. In other words, you know, we talk about stability of the income. You still mm-hmm. probably can't make it as a single income family, but even approaching that is something where people might actually start to get a sense of themselves, and you know, the males might start to think, you know, maybe I deserve to have my own territory, and maybe it isn't okay.
Well, the Bakken kind of is their territory, even though they're Mexicans and blacks up here.
Well, that's precisely my point. I mean, even given the fact that they have all this invasion that's being supported, it's still not as oppressive as the general environment.
And the joke up here with the truck drivers is don't tell Obama we're making money or he'll shut it down.
Right. Well, but the thing is that there's very little choice because of the economics of oil and energy. So it's one of those things where, you know, if they could, I mean, what they did with the information industry was they had guys like me who were making enough money that, you know, they might actually be able to get some kind of defense against what was going on, and they had to bring in the Indians to take us out. And, you know, anytime you have a frontier like that, you know, the nation mm-hmm. of settlers will be out there pioneering it, and you got to be careful, especially after mm-hmm. what's been done to us, because if you allow that to go on very long, somebody might, you know, people might start waking up, and they might start getting resources together to defend themselves. So that's one of the reasons I think that this kind of frenzy gets unleashed on you know, really pathetic attempts such as yours to try to put together, you know, even a small out of the way, you know, piece of territory, because it's really...
Well, yes. I did know that the confluence of those names in one town, in fact, I solicited your participation for personal reasons. You could not, but nonetheless, the number of names here, when I say names, I mean well-known. I thought it might upset them, and sure enough, I was right, you know?
Yeah. So. Well, you know, like I said, I supported what you were doing because of the fact that there are so many young men out there that mm-hmm. just need to get up there to find work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there was some kind of social support network, it was like Obama as a community organizer, right? And so the function mm-hmm. of the community organizer is especially in the black community, is to make sure that they've got all the access to the government programs and benefits they can get, as well as forming their voting blocks and making sure that they've got responsive representation. And, you know, although what you were doing wasn't anywhere like that so much, it was more private sector and providing jobs. It's the kind of thing where, you know, just sort of relieving some of the torment some of these young men are experiencing. So I think that was a good thing if it could have worked.
Well, you know, you pointed out to me that my thread on BNN about coming up here, that's over 30,000 hits now, and probably many, many people came in. Now, remember I told you the story, I was in Williston Library, and the guy, you know, he's a good-looking fellow, and he said he had six or seven, I'm pretty sure it was seven, and he was in his late 40s, and he had come, and he said, "Are you Craig Cobb?" He told me that in the library. And I said, "Yes," and he wanted to shake hands and talk to me and said that I came because of you and I got a job and I'm making about 73 after my probation period of 3 months or something like that. So I was really excited about that.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing I was talking about. You know, that's why I saw that what you were doing is being a positive thing. I mean, you know, independent of the propaganda value that you were seeking with the big names, it's just there are so many young men that just cannot form families because of the economic circumstances, as well as social circumstances, as well as being vilified because they're heterosexual white males.
Well, Potok included that in some of his accounts, you know, in Hate Watch. He said, listen, what makes this dangerous is that there are high-paying jobs up there.
Yeah, and, it's like well, you know, he would have to do is go, you know, listen to Elizabeth Warren's speech that she gave to the Jefferson Society about the collapse of the middle class, to see that, you know, the demographic collapse of whites in the United States, which is being filled by immigration, is a direct result of the absence of those jobs. So, you know, it's so utterly irresponsible, these people, to attack, you know, guys who are white for being masculine and trying to get enough money to support families, you know, that, you know, while at the same time they're saying, well, the reason they're dangerous is because they would commit genocide against us, when the genocide and tens of millions has been going on against the nation of settlers for the last generation by these people. And
I'm not an original thinker like you and Alex, but let me tell you something I'm pretty much memorized from Alex, is pretty darn close, and that is, in terms of what you just said, we are Jews, we rule you, do not broach our taboos, or you will pay a penalty of loss of freedom, a job, employment, social status, many other things.
Well, but more to the point, loss of population. I mean, this is my point about the race replacement that's going on. Is that if you look back at the sort of the iron law of wages, that basically said, you know, when you get this kind of international trade going on, the wage level will tend to go down to subsistence. Well, back before birth control and before women's liberation, et cetera, subsistence did not include taking out reproduction. I mean, now you can decrease, now you can lower the effective family economic viability. The way Elizabeth Warren talks about it is that, you know, looking at the family as a little business unit, the middle-class family has become insolvent and essentially does not have a risk-adjusted income that can responsibly support children, which is why, you know, for example, that Minnesota blonde that you talked to doesn't have children, really. She can't responsibly do it. And
maybe that's the source of her angst, because she looked down and she looked actually guilty and sad.
Well, you know, that's a big part of it. And, you know, I think that she's sort of maybe by encountering you in your actual circumstances and the reality of who you are, it's dawning on some part of her consciousness that civilization is being inhumane to European males the same way.
Well, I'm pretty sure she felt that. I could tell from, you know, I'm not the swiftest arrow in the quiver when it comes to understanding body language in women, but having lived decades, I get it more than I used to. And she was very, it was very pleasurable to watch the emotions and things on her face and watch her smile and hear what she said.
Yeah.
At one point at the end, she said she kept insisting to come to my house. And, you know, you can imagine with working 70-hour days and everything, I'm not the best housekeeper or anything. I said, no. And I said, I have two weapons by my bed and blah, blah. She kept wanting to come in. And I knew she was married. We kind of just joked all through the day. When the black was off talking to other people or we conversed, they said, well, you can come in and stay the night if you want. But I just told her to be a little impertinent because they can be very pushy. But mostly she was, you could see, it was really, they can't hide their emotions so well. I think not as well as men in some cases. Something about it, it was really pleasurable to see. If I would say something that seemed to make a lot of sense to her, she'd kind of raise her chin up and smile. And sometimes they weren't the most non-controversial comments I was making or observations.
Yeah.
Which pleased me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've got a domestic issue I have to deal with, so let's...
Okay, I hope it sounded all right there, James. Okay.
Okay, thank you much. Talk to you later. Bye.